Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's mere moments before 11. And coming up next is the Recovery Zone. Today, Stephanie, sorry, just based on your name there for 2 seconds, Stephanie's going to speak with Mark Beckoff, author of The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. And we'll get right to that in just a moment after a couple of announcements. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.
Girl, KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. The Willamette River Festival is a celebration on the waterfront with live music by Shanghaied on the Willamette, Norman Sylvester, and more, as well as a beer garden, food carts, an environmental fair, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and more. Again, that's the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th, from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and support from the Oregon Country Fair, July 7th, 8th, and 9th, featuring food, music, and crafts in Vineta, Oregon. Admission and parking tickets are available only at Tickets West, as absolutely no tickets will be sold at the fair site. Directions to this family event and visitor information available online at OregonCountryFair.org.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. Today, we're going to take a look at what we as humans need to do to repair our relationships with other animals and why we need to do it and how we can make that happen. My guest today, Mark Beckoff, is a field biologist who specializes in non-human animal behavior, and he's co-authored a book with bioethicist Jessica Pierce called The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. Dr. Beckoff, besides being a field biologist, he's also a professor emeritus at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's won a lot of research awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, and he's published numerous books and essays, including The Ten Trusts with Jane Goodall, The Emotional Lives of Animals, and Rewilding Our Hearts, which is actually a book I interviewed him about a few years ago. And Dr. Beckoff, you're here with us, right?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I thought we could just start easy, with a sort of a general what you and Jessica were actually hoping to accomplish with this book, why you wrote it.
Yeah, well, I mean, excuse me, we wrote it for a number of reasons, but over the years, as we were planning the book and writing it, we've become increasingly disillusioned with how the science of animal welfare and animal welfare itself patronizes non-human animals. I'm going to call them animals from now on. Because basically, while there are some improvements in the way in which non-humans are treated, it almost invariably comes down to in the name of humans. So you give you know, chickens in battery cages, slightly more room or slightly larger cages for rats or mice in a lab, or slightly large cages for elephants in a zoo, but they don't really do much for the animals. And so people say we're improving the welfare, we're giving them a better life, but a better life is not necessarily a good life. So that was basically the reason that we sat down and started planning this book a few years ago.
And you're like an animal behaviorist, Jessica's a bioethicist. How did that play off with each other in terms of doing this book?
Oh, it's great. We wrote a book called Wild Justice together that was published in 2009. I have some background in philosophy, and she's got some background in animal behavior and biology, but really we complement one another. I always learned when I was writing all my other books that in order to really explain something well to a broad audience who aren't experts, you really need to know the field. So we complement one another really well. She can explain the philosophical principles in language that non-philosophers can understand, and I can get the biology through.
Right.
And we both share a passion, if you will, for improving the lives of non-human animals in just a wide variety of venues.
Right. Well, I really got the feeling, like the sense of immorality in the way that we're treating them just came through really powerfully for me, you know. And I think a lot of that had to do with something that you started with in the beginning of the book. And I guess the immorality could be bioethicism or whatever. But you called it the knowledge translation gap. And could you explain to people what that is and why that's so important?
Sure. I mean, the gap really refers to the lack of transferring what we know about other animals into how they're treated. So we know that, animals are cognitive. They have very rich and deep cognitive and emotional lives. We know that they're sentient. They can feel pain and suffer. And people say, well, we want to improve the welfare of these animals, but we need science to know. Some people say if they suffer, which to me is just the most absurd question in the world. Some say, well, how they suffer. And so the gap really refers to the lack of that transfer of information to be used on behalf of the animals. The best example we can think of, although there's many, is that in the United States Federal Animal Welfare Act, rats and mice are not considered to be animals. And when the Animal Welfare Act was written and then amended, there's now a sentence that says we have redefined animal to exclude rats of the genus Rattus and mice of the genus Mus, which are lab animals.
So even other rats are okay now, like a roof rat wouldn't be tortured.
Right. Well, they're not worried about the animals who they don't torture. That's exactly right. And so writing off lab, saying they're not animals is absurd. Try explaining that to a fourth grader or even a younger person. But it's all self-serving. And I've written a number of essays, where have all the scientists gone? I mean, I talk to scientists about this all the time, and many to whom I talk think this is the most absurd omission in the world. And I'll say, well, why don't you change it? And they don't change it because it helps them. It means they can basically do anything they want to lab rats and lab mice and many other animals. And there's a fortune of money in the breeding industry. People don't realize that, we read about puppy mills, but people don't realize that there are companies that actually breed millions of rats and mice solely to be used in research.
And you describe some science studies that are showing that these rats and mice that supposedly aren't even animals, they actually have some of the same kind of consciousness that we have. Could you tell a little about that?
Well, sure. There was a wonderful scientist who died recently named Jaak Panksepp, who did this classic research showing that rats like to be tickled. When you analyze their vocalizations, they resemble laughter. and they like to play. Now this is a no-brainer. I mean, people knew that, but Jaak had to demonstrate it, you know, scientifically. And so there you go. They have positive emotions, and if they can have positive emotions, they can have negative emotions, like, you know, the ability to suffer and be harmed. And so, you know, rats and, of course, other laboratory animals do amazing things. They have great memories. They can recognize kin and family members who they've never met. And really, if you just look at what they can do and compare them to what chimpanzees and other animals can do, there's very little difference. I mean, there's differences because of their lifestyle, but in terms of the sophistication of their cognitive abilities and the depth of their emotions, there's basically no difference.
Yeah, which is sort of, you know, we're learning that about birds and all kinds of animals that are social, but even octopuses. I mean, it's amazing to me, but we do have a call. A woman named Roberta wanted to ask a question.
Yep. Hi.
Yeah, are you there?
Yes, hi. Thank you for sharing this information, and you mentioned the Animal Welfare Act, and I just wanted to give you some feedback about a situation that I was confronted with on a very personal and local level, and it has to do with an animal dealer. And those are the people who go out into the community and take animals to be sold to research laboratories. So that's directly connected with the Animal Welfare Act. And I have been going out to the community and letting people know what's going on. But I just wanted to let the listening audience know that we do have an advocate in the United States Congress by the name of Representative Earl Blumenauer. He is an animal rights advocate, and he is calling these animal dealers animal abusers, and he is doing everything in his power to go after them. And you go to his website, and you will find all of that information contained in his letter. And he wants people to call him who are in support and concerned about this issue, because what is happening with this is pets are being taken, which is illegal, but the Animal Welfare Act is not being enforced at the federal level. So I just wanted to, pass that commentary along to you on behalf of all the animals and the people that are suffering because
We'll try to bring this up again, too, when we talk toward the end of the show. I'd like to, what can we do about this?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We'll bring that up again.
That's one advocate that we have at the federal level, and then you have me at the local level, and so we'll just have to keep searching for more advocates, because this is a huge problem. It's a nationwide problem.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Roberta,
for listening, and like I say, keep up the good work. It's great to hear, you know, what you're saying.
Great.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Well, so basically, yeah, I mean, and I guess back to what you were talking about with rats and stuff, there's this sort of notion that some animals are lower order and some animals are higher order, because there have been, as Roberta mentioned, there are these welfare laws, actually, that are trying to do something about it. You mentioned something in the book called the Bramble Report, and then there was the 3 R's of research. But you're saying these just don't go far enough, and maybe we can start talking a little about that. For instance, in the 3 R's of research, they want to just let animals be harmed more if they're quote lower order.
Yeah, I mean, which from a biological point of view is absurd. There's no such thing as lower and higher animals. I mean,
not even people, huh?
No. Well, that's right, and that's a great way to put it, Stephanie. No, there are no higher and lower people. We can classify them if we want that way, but, like, for example, some people will talk about lower animals such as rats and mice, and then we discover that they're phenomenally smart. They have very rich and deep emotional lives, and then they can do things, you know, rats and mice can do things chimpanzees can do. And people go, wow, I didn't know that. And I'm thinking, well, you know, of course they do, or they can. They just have different lifestyles and they have different needs. The problem, too, is not only is, you know, use of the word lower and higher biologically incorrect, the word lower gets translated into less valuable, disposable, and the word higher often gets translated into more valuable, you know, more important. I mean, you can, you know, cash it out any way you want. But it really bristles me when I hear scientists talk about, well, the lower animals, such as rats or mice or fishes. Well, we now know fishes have amazing cognitive and emotional lives. So we need to be careful about that. But getting back to your question, no, the rules are not enforced. I mean, it blows people's minds when they read studies. They'll read most, you know, a lot of the people will read studies like that we report in our book or in popular media. They don't read the scientific literature. And I get emails a lot and people going, I read the results of this study and I saw the methods involve some kind of horrific abuse, and that is sanctioned by the Animal Welfare Act. So that gets back to your original question, Stephanie, is why we wrote this book. And, you know, later we can talk about the science of animal well-being, which is what Jessica and I advocate.
Well, actually, yeah, maybe we can even get into that sooner. I want to let listeners know we're talking to Mark Beekhoff. He's speaking to us from Colorado about a book he co-authored with Jessica Pierce called The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. And this is the Recovery Zone here on KBOO Portland. But maybe let's go to actually the idea that this book is actually saying that, well, because of the translation gap, it seemed to me that we are starting to understand that through research that a lot of animals are a lot more sentient, a lot more conscious, and experience a lot more suffering than we were even acknowledging in the 60s or the 70s. I mean, we're starting to know this now. And you're saying that we have to change from animal welfare to well-being. But this is actually going to take a paradigm shift. So first of all, let's go back to like the whole idea of the difference between welfare and well-being.
Well, yeah, like I said before, animal welfare basically trades off the costs to the animals and the benefits to the humans. There's very little research done on non-human animals that directly goes back to them. I mean, it just is. I mean, we could argue that, you know, when we learn certain things about reproductive patterns, mating habits, habitat preferences, that will go back into, say, conservation protocols, and it might. But really, the abusive research, the invasive research, is done in the name of humans.
We're not concerned, basically.
As welfareists, they're not concerned with individual animals. People will go, well, there's a million rats, so it doesn't really matter if we work on, you know, 100,000 of them. The science of animal well-being, which is, to some people, a subtle change, but it's a very powerful change in how we interact with other animals, focuses on the well-being of individual animals. Every single lab mouse, every single lab rat, every single brown rat, every single invasive animal, you can just, you know, run down the whole panoply of animals. Each and every individual has the right to have a good life. We need to value their interests in living peacefully and safely. And that's what it basically deals with. It's focusing on individuals. And you know, the easiest example, I often say to people, well, would you do it to a dog? Would you allow a dog to be treated in a way in which mice and rats and chimpanzees and elephants and lions and tigers and so many other animals are treated? And they'll go, you know, a lot of them go, why'd you ask that? You know, would you allow a dog to go onto a factory farm? And they'll go, of course not. And I explain to them, by bringing it home, if you will, that dogs are no more sentient than factory farm cows or lab mice or lab rats, for example.
Or pigs.
They're not higher animals.
Yeah, I guess I'm talking about pigs. I went to a pig rescue place once.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, they were just so sweet, these pigs, you know, and actually clean and social and friendly and curious. And, I mean, it was just amazing to me, you know, the the dog likeness of a pig, you know, basically.
Yeah, and people don't understand that a bacon lettuce and tomato sandwich is really a babe lettuce and tomato sandwich. And
yeah.
Kids, when they discover that, kids are really appalled. They don't know that bacon or sausage or ham was once a pig, nor do, you know, until a certain age do they know that a burger was a cow. And I'm not saying that in an obnoxious way. I'm just saying it because they just don't know this. So the dog analogy or metaphor is really, it really, really works. And it opens the door for reasoned discussions. I mean, that's what we've tried to do in the Animals Agenda. You know, we're not coming down on people harshly. We're basically using what they do and how they say things to discuss how welfare, once again, patronizes animals and doesn't really protect them adequately.
Yeah, and there was, like, as I said just a little earlier before that, the KABU identification there, there's something called the Bramble Report that came out in the 1960s, and it was about animal welfare, and it was trying to address that, but you're really feeling it doesn't go far enough. But could you tell us what the Bramble Report was and why you just really don't like it?
Oh, yeah, the Bramble Report was published in the 60s in the UK to protect farm animals.
And it was the first thing that came out that ever was even done like that, right?
Yeah, they produced the five freedoms, and I honestly don't remember them offhand, but there was freedom that animals had to have food and water, for example. Animals had to have space so that they could stand up and stretch their wings. I'm not being facetious about this. And so the Bramble Report was very forward-looking back in the 60s, and as we mentioned in the book, it took into account a lot of what we knew about non-human animals 50-some-odd years ago. So that was really the first formal, if you will, sort of discussion.
Yeah, I have
of
it
the
here.
Need to give animals certain freedoms.
Right. I have it here in your book, Freedom from Hunger and Thirst, Freedom from Discomfort, I guess that's the space, Freedom from Pain and Injury and Disease. But here's like a couple of trickier ones. Freedom to express normal behavior, but this is only by providing sufficient space and proper facilities. And then finally, freedom from fear and distress.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, you should be free of, you know, that's why you bring in the dog example. You want your dog living in fear and stress for all of his or her life. Exactly.
Which doesn't seem even possible in a factory farm. I mean,
no, it's impossible.
Yeah. So
I mean, it's literally impossible.
Yeah.
So yeah. So that's what we meant by, you know, and in all fairness, like I said, that's why we, you know, pointed out that in some ways we're afraid that animals are being more mistreated today than they were 50 years ago because we know so much more. And the numbers of animals being used is increasing,
right,
despite the fact that we know so much more than when the Five Freedoms were published in the early 60s.
So there's more, there's actually billions of animals, like in factory farms, in research labs. Is that basically the numbers that we're looking at there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you got to look at it globally. A lot of people are just sort of like, you know, Western Hemisphere centric or something like that. Oh, yeah, billions. And then you have to take into account fishes. People say, oh, they're just streams of protein. No, they're not. I mean, fish suffer. We've known for years that fish process morphine in the same way that humans do. And there's a book published by Jonathan Balcom last year, What a Fish Knows. It's a couple of hundred pages discussing the cognitive and emotional lives of fishes. And so you start, you know, when you start factoring in fish and then you start factoring in insects who we know, many of whom feel pain, you know, you could be talking about countless billions or trillions of animals. And the numbers are staggering.
But don't people object, you know, like, okay, we need the animals for research to save human lives. We need these animals to feed us. I mean, how do you counter that kind of thing?
Well, the first counter is that we don't. I mean, especially, you know, once again, I can say today, meaning, you know, the last decade or so, there's numerous non-animal alternatives for research and teaching, for example, that are as effective as animal models. People don't realize that around 92 or so of all drugs that pass animal tests do not pass human tests, for example. And people debate that number, but no one debates the fact that the vast majority of drugs that are tested on animals don't work on humans or have adverse effects. So basically, we don't need the sorts of research that one might argue we needed years ago.
We can do it in different ways, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but let's think about today. There's, you know, if you just do a search online for non-animal alternatives in research, you'll get so many hits, and you'll also see that a lot of the non-animal studies, work better. They have better results than animal models. And a lot of scientists agree with that for diabetes and other studies, or other diseases. So we don't need them anymore. And the other thing that we point out in the book, which I think is hugely important, that once again perhaps non-researchers don't think about, is the better the animals are treated, the more reliable the results. Because stressed animals, for example, will respond to drugs and other sorts of treatment different from non-stressed animals.
Yeah, that made a lot of sense.
And researchers know that. I mean, and once again, you know, I get encouraged, since I am a practicing scientist, that some of my colleagues will actually say, well, we need to do better because we need more reliable data. I mean, I wish that they would also say we need to do better because we need to treat the animals more humanely or not use them at all. But, you know, I'll take anything.
Right.
But it's really important to remember that data, or the quality of data, suffers when animals are abused.
We do have a caller again.
Sure.
Gosha? Or
Malgosha.
Malgosha. Hi.
Malgosha.
Oh, okay. I thought you wanted to talk now.
I'm a psychologist in Portland, and I was quite involved with a little bit more in the past with animal welfare and rights issues. And there's a veterinarian and an anesthesiologist. They're a couple, and they have done tremendous work. They've written several books that absolutely show that the animal-to-human model is completely defunct, and that at the cellular level, there's no comparisons. And there's one chapter in their book, Sacred Cows and Golden Geese, discusses all of the horrible, one of them being thalidomide, mistakes that have been made because drugs have been tested on animals and then assumed to be safe for humans. So, you know, that was a while back when thalidomide caused the birth of so many deformed children with the flippers instead of arms. But there's a whole chapter in that book. But he has also written, and this is straight science, Specious Science, another book that he wrote. And then he wrote another one entitled, What Will We Do When We No Longer Experiment on Animals? And it all came out of when his wife went to vet school, and he's an anesthesiologist, and she would come home and he would say, well, let me tell you how it is. And she'd say, no, it's not like that in vet school. We have different, you know, we have different information. And they came to recognize that the animal research model, and with all of the advances in technology and science and computers, and, you know, I can't even speak to it at this moment. It's a completely useless model that's just based in easily reproducible research and a huge industry based in money.
Right.
And just not wanting to shift the paradigm. So I just wanted to throw that in. And he's an excellent writer. So the books by Ray Greek, Doctors Greek, are amazing. And thank you so much for your show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Malgosha. I mean, that's really good information, you know, and I especially that at the cellular level, we're pretty identical. Yeah.
We're not identical.
I mean, well, no, not identical, but
has really done a lot.
We can't extrapolate from animal research to human paradigms and human.
Oh, in terms of research, yeah.
In terms of research, we're not identical.
Right.
We're so different that we make a lot of mistakes. And that, yes, it used to be a model that maybe gave us some data and some information, but now it is completely just needs to fall down. There needs to be a scientific revolution that says, as like in Thomas Kuhn, the structure of scientific revolutions, the whole thing has to fall down because it's useless.
Well,
Well said.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for your show. I have to run.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you, Nagosha. Yeah. Again, I'll just take a break right here again to say that animal behavior biologist Mark Beckoff is here talking about his book he co-authored with bioethicist Jessica Pierce, The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age. This is The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, and you can call in with your questions. The number is 503-231-8187. And so basically, how about the idea of a paradigm shift? I mean, you're talking about that's something that we really need to make happen. But is that possible? And how would it work? And what would it be, even?
Well, excuse me. The major paradigm shift would be really employing the tenets of the science of animal well-being, focusing on the value of the life of every single individual. But of course, another paradigm shift would be people changing their meal plans, people recognizing the incredible shortcomings of research on non-human animals and starting to use much better non-animal alternatives. I mean, those would all be paradigm shifts. I mean, paradigm shift, you know, would be turning zoos into sanctuaries. A paradigm shift would be just stopping, if you will, rodeos and circuses and other forms of entertainment where animals clearly are abused. But Jessica and I are realists to some extent, and we realize that the change is going to be slowly, it's going to be a slow change. One thing everyone could do right now is don't eat any animals or animal products from factory farms. And factory farms are slaughterhouses, and real farmers really hate hearing the phrase factory farms. They're not farms at all. They're just, you know, places where animals are produced and then brutally killed for food. But I really mean that. If people want to make a difference right now, add more compassion to the universe, expand what I call their compassion footprint, ask the source of an animal if you're going to eat them, and just do not eat any animals or animal products from the animal industrial complex, from places where these animals are reared solely for food.
Well, you did start your book. You went through, actually, factory farms, laboratory animals, animals for entertainment, and you even talked about companion animals and then finished with supposed wildlife, which actually we're managing now, so they're not as wild as they could be. So, but factory farms were like the most important in a certain way because you started the book with that. Was that sort of the idea there?
Well, we started the book there because the amount of pain, suffering, and death on factory farms and the animal industrial food complex
is enormous.
Alone is more than all the pain and suffering, you know, if you could quantify it, but in terms of just sheer numbers. And, you know, just imagining the total amount of pain, suffering, and death, it's more than all the other venues combined.
And actually, another thing on that that I was shocked when I read it, actually, was that, like lab rats, chickens, are for some reason, they're not included as animals that, I mean, they can just be slaughtered any old way. They're not part of the animals.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, think of all these baby chicks who are colored, died and crushed for Easter. I just saw part of a video. I can't watch these anymore. They really make me
I watched a few too a while ago. I couldn't.
I mean, you know, just of all these millions of baby chickens just being crushed.
But they don't have the same welfare rights that other animals have for some reason. Poultry doesn't?
No. And birds don't really under the Federal Animal Welfare Act either. You know, they're just birds, people will say. You know, ignoring the fact that we know that they're sentient beings, ignoring the fact that they do amazing cognitive, they have amazing cognitive capacities. So, no, that's a really good point, Stephanie, by asking. We began there because I talk to people a lot. I talk to them nicely. You don't get anywhere by being in their face. And when I try to explain to them the sheer numbers of animals who are in the animal food industrial complex, if you will, it's staggering. fishes. I mean, people just pick up big nets of fish, you know, they just troll, they get the animals, and, you know, they decide which ones they want to use and who they don't want to use. The numbers are, they blow my mind.
I do this stuff
every day, and when I look at the numbers, it just makes me so sad.
Yeah, well, and another thing about it that I think in terms of a paradigm shift that might be possible, you quoted a primatologist, I guess her name was Sue Savage Rumbaugh, and she said that we need to really change how we talk about, like, these animals that are on the factory farms or something in terms of just the words that we use.
Yep.
Like, we don't talk about them. We talk about them as the males and the females, if we do that. With animals, we'll talk about them as commodities when they're food. Like, and she's talking about how changing they're individuals. They would like to have wives. They want children. They have relatives. They have friends.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk more about, like, the words that we're using and how that's...
Oh, sure. I mean, Sue's right. I mean, I always say we talk to as animals as who, not it, that, or which. And a big paradigm shift could be people talking about who's for dinner, who they're eating, not what they're eating. And I have a great story that goes along with it. I've had a few like this. I gave a talk in Vienna about 5 or 6 years ago, and I talked about who's for dinner. Fully a year later, 5 women sent me an email, and they all went vegetarian because of what I said about who's for dinner. It took them a while. I don't mean that as a criticism at all, but all of a sudden they realized that they're eating a hamburger and they're eating a cow. That's a who.
Right.
A cow is a who, not the cow is a who, not a which in it or that. And so the words we use, we talk about steak, hamburgers, pork, veal, sausage, bacon. We don't talk about cow, pig. Chicken is an interesting one. You know, you have Kentucky Fried Chicken, which, you know, is just a horrifically abusive industry. So chicken retains, turkey, duck. And I think, number one, is there's no other way to talk about them. You could say we're having fried bird tonight or something like that.
Right.
But it's interesting. Someone asked me the question of why I thought we're having fish tonight, and that refers to the animals who we're eating, not like steak, you know, which is just completely removed from the cow from whom the steak came. And I wonder if some of it has to do with some kind of latent or not so latent lack of recognition that people think that these animals aren't emotional. We know chickens are. We know chickens display empathy. We know fish do. But the words we use are critical. You could say, we're having cow tonight.
Right. Or even like thinking of a cow as a mother. We're having someone's mother tonight. There's a song about that.
I refer to, you know, biologists like to talk about offspring and the young and the offspring, and I refer to them as children because they are children. And I was talking to somebody recently, I wrote an article about a chimpanzee and her children, and it wasn't an email that was in my face, but the woman who wrote to me said something like, wow, you know, I've never really thought of it that way. And once again, it's not because she's stupid. It's not that people aren't smart. It's just that scientists don't want to talk about children.
Right.
They want to talk about the young.
The way a cow just bawls when she's separated from her child, and the child is bawling back, you know. But we do have another call again. What was her name again? Sunny. Sunny, would you like to ask your question?
Well, I just wanted to say I was going to go into the kitchen and make myself an egg, and I'm not going to.
Ah.
So, you know, and I know that what you say is right, and it's certainly worth saying it again and again. And the last thing I wanted to say is, as it appears that we cruise ever closer to war, then as we learn new dietary ways and sharing and getting to know our neighbors, we can all recover together, and I just think this is an important show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I won't have my egg,
and I'm going to try harder to go back to vegetarian and vegan. Thank you.
Oh, that's so sweet, Sunny. And
that's a lovely call. And And I think a lot of, you know, I meet a lot of people like that. You know, a lot of people get very impatient. You know, they'll say, well, why didn't you do this before? Or you got to do this today. And my attitude is you put it out there and you just have to have people at some point incorporate these changes
right.
into their lifestyle. It can be dietary. It could be the use of, you know, different cosmetic or medical products. Boy, that's a very powerful phone call.
That's great. And yeah. And Kyle is also on the phone. Kyle, would you like to ask your question?
Oh, yeah. You know, I just was listening to your conversation, and I thought it was really, it's very interesting. And I still eat meat. You know, I don't eat a lot. I've cut severely back on beef to the point where I only buy the stuff that's supposedly grown in eastern Washington and Oregon anyway.
Right.
You know, and I still don't feel good about it, so I try and cut back on that further. And then chicken, you know, I eat that all the time, but then this is going to sound funny, but I was watching America's Got Talent the other night, and here's a chicken that played America the Beautiful from A to Z with its beak. I am not kidding you, you're laughing, but this chicken played America the Beautiful. And I go, that chicken ain't so stupid if it can play America the Beautiful, or if it can play anything, you know. You know, then I watched some time ago, I watched the guy doing the stupid shark tricks, you know, the guys in the, got to get out there and, oh, we're so bad because we can be with sharks, you know. But there was this guy who was sitting there, he was petting the shark underneath the chin, and the shark was eating it alive, loved it. I mean, and I couldn't believe it, you know, I was like, geez, you know, there's a known predator, you know, I mean, kids don't try this at home, you know, but... And, you know, then I watch pictures and videos of the crows who drive me nuts in the morning around here. But, you know, they're an alarm clock for me, and they know it. But anyway, open cages with food in it with manufactured tools that they made themselves. They'll actually choose a tool that works for them to break into the cage to get the food out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who are we to think that these animals cannot think and do things, you know,
and they have so their...
They're not higher reasoning? I think they are.
Right.
Some of them, yeah.
And that's a great point that you're making. Is it Kyle?
Kyle.
Yes.
Kyle.
Yeah.
That's a great point you're making, Kyle. And that was the point I was trying to make before, but I didn't give any good examples, that's why the word higher and lower just doesn't make sense. I mean,
no.
Mexican jays and a lot of different jays can remember the location of hundreds of food caches and not go back to one where the food has been taken. I go to my cupboard looking for potato chips, and I go, oh, my God, I finished them yesterday.
The crows around my neighborhood, they know me. They know my face.
Well, you know, there's been research done on crows. At the University of Washington, there's a great researcher named John Marsloff and his team. When a baby crow learns the identity of a human at like something 2 days, they remember that for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
Literally.
Well, I've got a friend that feeds them, and they know her and they follow her around. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When I lived in the mountains, I used to have a magpie follow me and my dog. And he would, it turned out it was a male magpie. He would hop from tree to tree in the big fields by my mountain home. And he was talking to my dog. I mean, it was just amazing. And we know that magpies are phenomenally interesting, and they show the same sorts of self-recognition as do chimpanzees.
Which we call sentience.
I share one more story. It was in local here. It was a little girl who was feeding crows in the backyard of one of her, and the neighbors started to complain because so many crows were coming into their backyard and she was feeding them. Well, the crows were also bringing her shiny objects and presents,
you know,
in return for her food. I mean, they were bringing her little rings and screws and shiny pieces of mirror and stuff like that, you know, and dropping it for her, you know. I thought that was pretty cute. But, you know, on the other hand, it's also like, you know, they're communicating, you know.
Right.
They're forming friendships. That's another word that up until a few years ago, I actually had some colleagues asking seriously, can animals form friendships. And I'm thinking, have you ever lived with a dog?
Right. Oh, well, yeah. Or cat.
And so, no, your point is really well taken. They form friendships. We can call them social bonds. We can call them social relationships. But who knows if that was their way of thanking, whether they were bartering, whether they were trading. But the fact is, they knew what they were doing. There was just a wonderful study published on temple monkeys. This was in Thailand, and we've known the same for monkeys in India. They will steal eyeglasses and then barter them back to the humans from whom they stole them for food.
Yeah,
that's good.
I mean, so
the stupid humans.
See, Cobb, not even, you know, even though you haven't, maybe you've had a course in animal behavior, your observations are really important and poignant because you're seeing this stuff every single day.
Yeah, that's true.
I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your sharing too, and I appreciate the program. I'll get off now. Let somebody else get on.
Okay, thank you, Kyle. And I just again want to let listeners know I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Beckoff, talking to us about a book he co-authored with Jessica Pierce, "The Animal's Agenda: Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age." This is the Recovery Zone here on KBOO Portland. And I wanted to ask you again, just to go back to, like, you know, how do we change? I think it sounds like just talking with Kyle that one of the biggest things we have to get past is this sense of our own human exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what just comes through for me.
And we're not exception. Right. So Kyle was talking about all the cognitive capacities of these animals. And while they're very important, people working in animal welfare and animal well-being are more concerned with feelings. And the reason I say this is because some people will go, humans are smarter and we suffer more than dogs. Well, number one, we're not necessarily smarter. We can do things that dogs can't do, and surely dogs can do things that we can't do. But we all have the capacity to suffer. So it's the ability to suffer that becomes the main variable, if you will, in influencing our treatment. And I wanted to, of the animals, I wanted to mention something before, because since your show is called The Recovery Zone, I write regularly for Psychology Today, and I push some of these essays over to Huffington Post. But I just published one this morning about a dog trainer named Marissa Martino. She wrote a book about basically how we can become better people through teamwork with dogs. And she shares some amazing stories about her own recovery, if you will. So I wanted to drop that in because there's a growing literature about how non-human animals can help people overcome a lot of psychological conditions. And some people are very critical of the studies. They'll say, well, the data aren't that strong, they're not that robust. And while some of the studies are stronger than others, my bumper sticker is, if something works for you, then do it. And I know from some of my own experience, it was rekindled by reading Marissa Martino's book and by talking to people, how soothing dogs can be and how they do help in recovery. And I've done some work with veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and their dogs. I gave a lecture on dog behavior, and then we talked about the human-dog relationship. So I just wanted to throw that in, Stephanie, because non-human animals, you know, they're bringing them into hospitals now, nursing homes, assisted living centers. They're used a lot with autistic kids. They're used with kids who are in trouble. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, there's a whole world of that. Yeah, I actually was a physical therapist and had a job for a little while with horses and kids, you know, where...
Oh, yeah. Horses are just incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
As, you know... therapist, if you will, yeah.
And also, though, this whole thing with human exceptionalism, we've also got, I read a book there's 7 billion of us. Supposedly by 2050, there'll be 9.8 billion if things don't implode, I guess. But And then I interviewed a woman once, Virginia Morell, who wrote a book called Animal Wise, and she mentioned that we've sort of taken for ourselves all the best real estate on this planet, you know, and and then there's this biologist, E.O. Wilson, and he's written a book called Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life, that we should actually be setting aside half the planet, like this would be another sort of solution. Have you run across that notion as a permanent reserve undisturbed by man? And do you think that's even feasible or a good idea? Or?
Excuse me. I really enjoy thinking about that, and E.O. Wilson's book is extremely convincing. You know, I'm a hardcore optimist. I really am. People sometimes say, how could you be positive with all the stuff that's going on? And I just am. I'm an optimist. I always look at the bright side of things. I would love to see areas put aside for the future, if you will. Areas where we don't go in and develop. Empty areas, even if there are no animals there, recognizing that some animals may just migrate there or be placed there by humans. The reason I don't see it is just because of the value of land and the fact that we as a population or as a species, you know, our numbers are growing. People don't like to talk about it, but, you know, the major problem is there's just too many of us. And so where are we going to go into finite space? I mean, or finite, you know, livable terrestrial space. So certainly that could be part of a paradigm shift, you know, where we just say, imagine this, Stephanie, we're going to put land aside for future generations. When I talk to people with kids, it sometimes astounds me how ignorant they are. I don't mean ignorant, but how they ignore the fact that when their kids are their ages, this is going to be a vastly different world in terms of resources, in terms of lifestyle, in terms of available habitat. They don't even think about that.
Well, yeah, when I think that when I was born, there was, I think, 2 billion or 2.5 or something, and now there's over 7 billion, 10 billion by 2050, or 9.8. And I can see, you know, myself, like how things have changed with how it's already tripled, you know. So, yeah, But I guess, like, even like wildlife corridors, because that was sort of what you wrote about in your other book, Rewilding Our Hearts, you know, just creating more places for animals to interconnect where they can do part of their agenda, which is to, you know, meet members of the opposite sex and mate and create their own families, you know, stuff like that. But then again, now I'm thinking, as I keep saying all this, we've got, especially in the White House right now, someone who actually wants to dissemble things like our national monuments and do uranium mining in the Grand Canyon. And I mean, where's your optimism with that going on?
Well, those are the examples that really pressure me. I mean, last year, Dan Ash, who was head of the U.S. Department of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, opened up national wildlife refuges to hunting and fishing. What's a refuge? My home is a refuge. I'd like to believe that I can be safe here, right?
Right.
The animals on these refuges can now be hunted and people go fish them. My hope comes, and it does, from doing shows like this, from interacting with youngsters. They're the ambassadors for the future. And it troubles me greatly to think that when I do a lot of kids' events, I do a lot of work with Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots groups, what's the world going to be like when these kids are half my age, not necessarily my age? I mean, what's the world going to be like 10, 15, 20, 30 years for them? And, you know, it's not only the loss of animals and their homes. It's not only the loss of habitat. It's just the whole sort of, it's just the whole kaleidoscope of the loss of land, the loss of animals, the loss of livable space, too many of us competing for limited resources, and people are fooling themselves, and I say this not as an alarmist, but our natural resources, you know, including water, for example, they are not infinite.
Mm-hmm.
We need, I mean, you know, it's getting back into just sort of energy. You know, I live in Boulder, Colorado, where it's sunny and there's a lot of solar here, but there's a lot of places where solar and wind energy could be used. So I'm just, you know, I guess my hope comes from getting people to know what's going on and to get them active in the ways that they can be active. I don't expect everyone to do what I do. I don't expect everyone to do certain things. But my bumper sticker for that is everyone who can do something positive for animals and Earth must do something positive, because there's a huge percentage of the people in this world who are just trying to live from moment to moment and who would do something if they could. So that's my take now, is that if you can do something, you need to do something. And we need to think of our planet or the inhabitants on this planet as a community. I was part of the United Nations Harmony on Earth. I can't remember the exact name of the program, United Nations Harmony Program. And it was based in this principle called Earth Jurisprudence. And the bottom line for that is that we are all a community, not only non-human animals and animals, but also flora, trees, bushes. We're all dependent on one another. And I know that sounds fluffy to some people, but I think if we don't recognize and act on this sense of being a unified community, what I do in Boulder affects what happens in Portland. I know people laugh at that, but it really does.
Yeah.
Not tomorrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so people, we're going to have to just form a real tight community on Earth of people who are like-minded and work really hard to make changes that are in our areas of interest or where we are able to make a difference.
Well, there's so many things I want to talk about, like the idea of the Anthropocene versus the Compassionocene, and the fact that Stephen Wise is working on animal rights and legal personhood for animals, and Sea Life London Aquarium is doing beautiful things, or rights of nature are happening in New Zealand, Ecuador, and Bolivia. But a fellow named Barnett just wants to talk for... Mr. Barnett, like you've got 30 seconds because we're going to be getting off. Mr. Barnett, could you just do your question really quick?
Yes, I can. It's not a question, it's a comment, that you really need to do yourself a favor and think about not only cycle paradigm shift, but there are people in various other areas working toward the same goal, not as far as, say, animals, but just, say, in politics and economics and
right.
Environment in terms of the Earth. There are a lot of other people moving toward paradigm shifts, so don't think of the work that you do in that kind of isolated terms of only non-human sentient beings. That's extremely important.
I agree with you.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to get into capitalism.
There's other reasons for this convergence that is possible.
Right.
I agree with you totally, Barnett, and that's what I was saying, is that we each have our areas of interest, and as long as we can make differences and work hard, then everyone has to work in whatever area they can work in. So thank you for sharing that.
Right. I mean, getting plastic out of the oceans is also going to help the fish, and all of this helps people in the end, you know.
Absolutely.
And why I was mentioning, changing our economic system. I mean, there's so many things, but...
Yeah, no, that's why I was just mentioning this Earth Jurisprudence Program, and I was mentioning this article that I just published today on Psych Today, how through non-human animals, we can become better people. There's going to be people who work for non-human animals. There's going to be people who work for human animals. There's going to be economists, political scientists, theologians, sociologists, anthropologists. No, seriously. So we all, the last thing I'll say is we all need to tap into who we are, what we're passionate about, and go from there. And in Rewilding Our Hearts, the book I wrote a few years ago, I talk about the 8 P's of rewilding and being proactive, passionate, positive, etc. That's what we need to do.
Right. So, and like a bumper sticker I just saw, make the earth great again. You know, all of it.
Yeah. I love that. I'll get myself a red hat.
Right. And so, just maybe you could let us know what your website is and just say like 10 or 15 seconds of any last words you'd like to give us.
Well, my website is simply markbekoff.com, markbekoff.com. No, I want to thank you, and I want to thank your callers and your listeners, because I've been doing a lot of these for different parts of the country and the world, and this is, it's a grassroots move, and
yeah.
That's what I love about it. I love science, but science is not going to save us. It's going to be, quote, non-scientists, normal people who care, like Barnett just called in. It's going to be normal people who care, and we all have to do something if we can.
Great. And it's really been great talking to you, Mark. I've been speaking with animal behavior biologist Mark Bekoff, who co-authored The Animal's Agenda, Freedom, Compassion, and Coexistence in the Human Age, a book that's been written to advocate for a new paradigm in our relationship with animals and our planet. And this has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. Thanks, Tammy, for her fine engineering, and thank you for listening.
It's noon, 12 noon. Marcia's here to bring you jazz shortly. But before that, we're going to go to the noon, KBOO Noon headlines. It's 12 o'clock noon here at KBOO Portland.
And now, the KBOO News at noon for Wednesday, June 28th, 2017. In the U.S. Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has postponed the vote on the Republican health care plan after facing opposition from all Senate Democrats and 9 Senate Republicans. A similar move was carried out in the House back in April, leading many to believe that the bill was dead, but it reappeared a week later and went straight to a vote on May 8th. In local news, 37-year-old Casey